Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Racial Gerrymanders and Equal Protection Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On March 1st, 2017, the Supreme Court decided Bethune-Hill v. Virginia State Board of Elections. Plaintiffs in Bethune-Hill each resided in one of 12 newly proposed majority-minority districts for the Virginia legislature, created to satisfy Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which requires that any new districting plan must ensure that there is no retrogression in the ability of racial minorities to elect the candidate of their choice. Plaintiffs argued that the new districts constituted racial gerrymanders that violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. A three-judge panel of the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Virginia disagreed, holding that the plaintiffs had failed to establish that race was the predominant factor in the creation of 11 of the 12 challenged districts. The District Court also held that, although race was the predominant factor in the creation of one district, District 75, the state legislature had satisfied the requirements of a compelling state interest and narrow tailoring. On appeal to the United States Supreme Court, plaintiffs argued that the district court panel erred in a number of respects, including in determining that the race could not predominate unless its use resulted in an actual conflict with traditional districting criteria. Plaintiffs also argued that the use of race in drawing House District 75 was not narrowly tailored to serve a compelling government interest. By a vote of 7-1, the Supreme Court affirmed the judgment of the District Court panel, in part, vacated it in part, and remanded the case. In an opinion delivered by Justice Kennedy, the court held that the District Court panel had employed an incorrect legal standard to determine whether race predominated, noting that challengers are permitted to establish racial predominance in the absence of an actual conflict by presenting direct evidence of the legislative purpose and intent or other compelling circumstantial evidence. The court rejected plaintiffs' challenge to District 75, however, determining that the legislature's action ultimately survived strict scrutiny. Justice Kennedy's majority opinion was joined by the Chief Justice and Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan. Justice Alito filed an opinion concurring in part and concurring in the judgment. Justice Thomas filed an opinion concurring in the judgment in part and dissenting in part. To discuss the case, we have Jack Park, who is of counsel at Strickland Brockington Lewis, LLP. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Park.
On March 1, 2017, the Supreme Court issued its decision in Bethune-Hill versus Virginia State Board of Elections. That case involved a challenge to the post-2010 redistricting plan for the Virginia House of Delegates. In a decision written by Justice Kennedy, the court reversed the decision of the three-judge federal district court in substantial part and remanded the case for further proceedings. Justice Alito concurred in part and in the judgment. Justice Thomas concurred in the judgment and dissented in part, and Justice Gorsuch, who was not yet on the court, did not participate. In the House of Delegates plan, Virginia brought 12 black majority districts in at 55% black voting age population. Each of those districts was previously one in which the majority voters could elect a candidate of their choice, and they were underpopulated. Virginia contended that the 55% figure was the product of an agreement between the House Black Caucus and the Republican leader of the House redistricting effort. The district court held that as to 11 of the 12 districts at issue, the plan did not subordinate other race-neutral redistricting considerations to race, noting that there was no actual conflict between traditional race-neutral redistricting criteria and race. In reaching that decision, the district court focused on the portions of the district lines that appeared to deviate from neutral criteria. As to the 12th district, the district court found that race predominated in its drawing. Even so, the district court said that the district met strict scrutiny because it was narrowly tailored. Justice Kennedy, in his opinion, acknowledged that electoral redistricting is a most difficult subject for legislatures, requiring a delicate balancing of competing considerations. Moreover, federal law, including decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court, require that on some level, race be considered. The court's decisions, however, require that it not be considered too much or in the wrong way. The wrong way is characterized as racial sorting, a notion that includes being personally subjected to a racial classification, as well as being represented by a legislator who believes that his primary obligation is to represent only the members of a particular racial group. In short, as the court explained, the Equal Protection Clause does not prohibit misshapen districts. It prohibits unjustified racial classifications. Or, as it put it in Miller v. Johnson in 1995, the constitutional violation stems from the racial purpose of state action, not its stark manifestation. Notwithstanding the need for extraordinary caution on the part of courts reviewing redistricting plans, the court found that the district court used the wrong analysis. It concluded that a conflict between district lines and traditional districting criteria is not a threshold requirement or a mandatory precondition for a finding of unconstitutionality, noting that the search for such a conflict might have been reconcilable with this court's case law at an earlier time. Instead, the lower court should look not only at those portions of a district's lines that cannot be explained by traditional redistricting criteria, but at the district as a whole. And even though the analysis is district by district, the challengers can present statewide or multi-district evidence. As the court said, a holistic analysis is necessary to give that kind of contextual evidence its proper weight. The court pointed to the significance of stark splits in the racial compositions of populations moved into and out of disparate parts of the district, or to the use of an express racial target. For 11 of the 12 districts at issue, the court remanded the case for further consideration of the extent to which, under the proper standard, race directed the shape of these 11 districts. If race did predominate, as to one or more of the 11, the district court would have to see whether strict scrutiny was satisfied. As to the 12th district, the court affirmed the district court's judgment that the district was narrowly tailored, concluding that the state had sufficient grounds to determine that the race-based calculus it employed in District 75 was necessary to avoid violating Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. For all of its discussion of the need to consider districts in a holistic fashion, the court recognized that, as a practical matter, in many cases, perhaps most cases, challengers will be unable to prove an unconstitutional racial gerrymander without evidence that the enacted plan conflicts with traditional redistricting criteria. And in the absence of a conflict with traditional principles, it may be difficult for challengers to find other evidence sufficient to show that race was the overriding factor causing neutral considerations to be cast aside. In his opinion, Justice Alito joined the court's opinion as to the 12th district, but suggested that the other 11 districts had to satisfy strict scrutiny. He thus agreed with Justice Thomas. And Justice Alito quoted from Justice Scalia's opinion in Lulac v. Perry. In Lulac, Justice Scalia concurred in the judgment and dissented in part. He said, when a legislature intentionally creates a majority-minority district, race is necessarily the predominant motivation, and strict scrutiny is therefore required. For his part, Justice Thomas would reverse the district court's judgment as to all 12 districts. He explained that the intentional drawing of black majority districts mandates strict scrutiny. In Justice Thomas's view, compliance with Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act should not be considered a compelling state interest. He rejected what he called a back-of-the-envelope analysis of District 75's demographics and its changes over time, observing, "I do not think we would permit so imprecise an approach with regard to any other evidence of racial discrimination." So he dissented from the court's decision with respect to District 75. Justice Thomas also criticized the court for failing to address the constitutionality of Section 5, a failure that, as he put it, left the states without clear guidance about its redistricting obligations under Section 5. He also noted this court has put the state in a similar bind with respect to narrow tailoring. Nonetheless, he would have the state lose because the Constitution is clear. What does this case suggest? First, it reminds us that state attempts to comply with Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which Virginia tried to do, rarely receive a sympathetic hearing in the Supreme Court. Second, with the focus on the demographics of the populations moved into and out of districts, which Justice Breyer favors, the difficulty of repopulating underpopulated black majority districts will be even harder to do when it comes time to do all this again after the 2020 census.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.fedsoc.org/multimedia.